that we should pick things up. Being a Republican, we should shift these costs down to the state, and I guess we should be happy to do that, to pick these costs up, even though we don't have the money either. I guess the way that I feel about it is that it's really a travesty that legal aid attorneys are looked upon somehow as being second-class attorneys from the standpoint of the pay that they get from the government. And I bet you there is not another government agency that has taken these cuts in their legal department, and though they probably over time gotten raises. And I think what it is a comment on the people that they represent. They represent poor people, so I think that they're looked upon as being second-class attorneys. So that's my editorial comment about this. And if they were regarded as being as important as anyone else, we wouldn't have this problem. We wouldn't be here fighting over increasing fees. I think just talking generally about these fee increases, I mean, it's just getting more and more expensive for everybody, regardless of what their reason are for filing lawsuits, and it's just got to stop at some point. I just think the whole thing's out of hand. But I support legal aid and what they do, and perhaps for other reasons than Senator Brennan mentioned, I don't like increasing small claims court, but I don't know, given their situation, I don't know what else we can do. It's true, is it not, that the fees paid by plaintiffs in circuit and district court don't nearly cover the cost of providing that court to them. So they, sure, too, are being heavily subsidized by the state in their access to the courts. And all this is saying that it seems fair for those who don't really have access to the court because they're indigent, that those who do and can afford the subsidized access to the court that we as a society provide ought to be willing to kick a little bit in to help those who don't have access. So I think it's, in my mind, it's perfectly fair and not penalizing those who use the courts and can pay to have them help those who can't.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gruske.
It seems to me that if there is a principle, an equitable principle that says that everyone should have access to the courts, and I'm not necessarily convinced that's true, but if you assume that it is, then that is something that society in general benefits from. Society in general should pay for it. As it now stands, the vehicle for this equity is only on the shoulders of those people who actually go to court, the very same people who will then have legal aid working against them. To me, that doesn't seem equitable. If it's a societal problem, it's a state problem, then the state of Oregon generally should be funding legal services, which I think they should.
But
we're also asking those people who go to court to pay for it. And I'm not sure that they are the people that necessarily should be then carrying this extra burden simply because they had to go to court to get their problem resolved. And I think that, I don't know how this fee thing ever got started in the first place, but I think it's the wrong way to raise money to ensure quality legal services for those people who can't afford them. And for that reason, I'm going to be voting against this bill, although I support legal services and hope we can get funding for them from other sources.
There are no other sources at the moment.
Well, it's a question of priorities. Apparently, the federal government hasn't made it one, and I think that's where the priority should be.
Anybody else? Comments? Call the roll, please.
Brennan?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Gruske?
No.
Snow?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Brenner?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've got one more bill that pertains to Catherine, and I don't want to keep her, so let's move into 412, which is contrary to what I announced in the beginning, but we always do things contrary to what we announced an hour earlier in this business, so may as well, I guess, get on to it earlier. But I do want to let Catherine go home and not wait around to the last for another 3 hours. It might take us.
What?
This is... Unless we get quicker, folks.
This is the bill that limits, or rather, that addresses psychotherapist liability. You have in front of you a set of -2 amendments. These amendments basically replace the existing bill and limit the liability of psychotherapist's duty to warn. The amendments specify the duty to warn is limited to specific parties who are clearly identifiable persons and readily identifiable persons. It also limits the duty to warn to specific circumstances, which are when the patient communicates an actual threat of personal injury directly to the psychotherapist. The bill specifies the duties, how the duty to warn is discharged, and specifically the psychotherapist has the option of telling the party, parent, or guardian and the police, or seeking commitment. And in the case of the PSRB, it must notify the PSRB and also the police. It requires the psychotherapist to notify patients of their duty to warn both at the beginning of treatment and also if there is a threat later on in treatment. It provides immunity for the psychotherapist for giving reasonable warnings. There is no effective date on the bill, and I have drafted a proposed amendment which basically would make the provisions of the bill apply only to causes of action arising after the effective date.
Catherine, we need to know what version of the bill we're deleting. We're talking about right now.
Dash two amendments basically got and stuffed the bill. They delete the provisions in the bill and rewrite the bill. And in front of you, you have a hand in, we have a typed version of the new bill.
Typed meaning redraft of Senate Bill 412.
Right, right.
That's it?
Right. And okay. Then you also have a set of dash two amendments that are LC, and they're dated 3/27/89.
And we're discarding 412-1?
Correct.
And Mike, Madam Chair, am I correct that the LC-2 amendments are the same as the redraft submitted under date of March 13 by the Oregon Psychological Association?
Yeah. Diane is saying no, but I believe that they were. I'm sorry.
Except for adding.
Could you come up, Diane, please?
Madam Chairman, Diana Godwin, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. They are identical except for in the amendments you see line 13 on page 1.
Of what?
Of the LC-2 amendments. Page 1, line 13, is added that does not appear in my hand engrossed bill.
To seek commitment of the patient under ORS Chapter 426 is added?
Yes. And we agree with that. The psychiatrist asks us to add that back in as one method by which you can discharge a date. And
I'm sorry, Diana, you're probably not aware of it, but John McCulley brought in a hand redraft, which is dated March 13th, which has it typed
in. Oh,
because so they are
mine
the same.
Draft is March 13th, and I didn't realize that. All right.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I have one addition with it in and one addition without it in. All right. So I have that here. That's okay.
Well, so it goes here. Catherine, you have yet another amendment?
Yes, Senator.
Would you pass it out quickly then so we can get it on the table in front of us so we know where we're going to do, if we're not going to do or not do here.
I would like to learn, Madam Chair, whether seeking commitment under Chapter 426 accomplishes what this bill is aimed at. I assume it does since the psychologist requested it, but I guess I'd like to understand what that does.
Okay, John, you want to come up and explain what sub B and the LC-2 really mean, ORS 426. I assume that's a civil commitment law?
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, John McCulley representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. This was a part of the original bill that, after all of the discussions, one draft had recommended deletion of it. We requested that it be kept since a physician and community mental health program director could have the ability to seek civil commitment of a person who may be a threat to harm himself, herself, or others. And at the time that that is occurring under this bill, it would be one option that the physician could use to discharge the duty to protect the public.
Madam Chair, what happens when you seek commitment?
A request, the physician can work with another physician and do what is known as a two-physician hold, which allows the person to be held pending an investigation of whether that person will be civilly committed through the court system. The power is also there for the community mental health program director or his designee to seek a hold on that person, which means that, again, the person would be detained until the civil commitment process works its way through and that person is either civilly committed or is released.
Must they detain under the Civil Commitment Act?
Senator Shoemaker, yes, the detention is to hold that person.
It's required?
It's my belief that, and my understanding that, yes, that is required.
Catherine, why don't you come on up? Quickly.
My name is Laura Sebastian. I'm a psychologist in private practice and chair of the Oregon Psychological Association Legislative Committee. My understanding of the commitment legislation, without looking it up, is that, yes, they are required to hold, provided the person meets the requirements for civil commitment.
Yeah, I guess what I'm concerned about, of course, is that they might seek commitment of the patient, but that would be a way to escape liability while permitting the patient to walk out of the office and do the very thing that he threatened to do. But they say, oh, yeah, we're seeking commitment. Therefore, we're off the hook, and if the patient's free.
My understanding, Senator Shoemaker, is that that doesn't have, or is not supposed to happen, that the commitment to be sought, the hold when it is placed, is that person is detained.
My understanding, Senator Shoemaker and Senator Cohen, is that it is covered under civil commitment, the civil commitment statutes.
Okay. So we want to read for a moment on 426, if you go ahead and do that.
Yeah.
Anyone else have comments?
Madam Chair, still not, maybe following up on the earlier question, it's still not clear to me just what to seek commitment means. Does that mean that a person has initiated by contacting another individual who's necessary or has contacted the law enforcement authorities, called the law enforcement authorities and say, hey, I think this person needs commitment, and then the officer goes out there exercising his or her judgment and takes a person into custody? It's not really very clear to me what that means.
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, I think that that's covered very specifically under the commitment procedures, the requirements of the person seeking civil commitment, either through community mental health or a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist in private practice.
Carl, do you want to come up? I don't want to argue the rest of the bill, but let's...
Well, there's just several ways you can start commitment.
Yourself.
Charles Williamson, the Oregon Travelers Association. I'm sure there's several ways you can seek commitment. One of them is a two-physician hold, which I think generally does result in custody, although I'm not sure it's required to result in custody. You can also go down and swear out an affidavit at the courthouse, and then it's several days before a person is actually brought to court and may not be placed in custody until after a hearing. So that there's certainly no guarantee that just because someone seeks commitment that they're going to be confined.
Okay, let's talk about the other parts of the bill, folks. Well, we're waiting for the other one. I know other folks, other members have had concerns about the bill in general, and I want you to read it over and see, because we've spent more time on this bill than a whole lot of other kinds of issues, and I do want to decide up or down on this bill in the next few minutes.
Which, Madam Chair, if I may be so bold, which of these in here are we supposed to read? The hand engrossed one? That one there, okay. Yeah,
but also look at sub B, which is an amendment just now.
Okay, I've got a hand engrossed in here somewhere. Two letters from here.
No.
I just saw it. There it is. That one?
No. It's right in the beginning of the packet. Here it is, right here.
Chair?
Senator Grinsky.
I'm just going to reiterate something I presented last time, and that is that, as I understood it from the testimony we had, the ethical obligations of psychotherapists at the present time already talk about the kinds of things they're supposed to do with these people. The testimony, as I heard it, indicated that it wasn't clear enough, and that's why they needed this bill. Well, it seems to me that, that they need to deal with their own ethical problems, if that's their problem, not come in here and do this. I think the real thrust of this bill is the limit on liability, the case in California, the case in Oregon, that expands psychotherapist liability. I think prompted this, basically, and I just don't see why we should limit liability in this respect for these kinds of people.
Senator Brent?
It has nothing to do with what the Senator brought up, but Senator Brockman's request, I'm working from the assumption, I didn't hear an answer to it, I know Catherine went down and talked to him, I'm working from the assumption we're looking at redraft of Senate Bill 412 dated March 13th, and to that, and that includes the Dash 2 amendments, and to that we being proposed this amendment you just passed out, right?
Yes, that deals with
that the effective date.
And effective date action. That's what we're looking at. And it specifies who to whom they have to communicate the threat, etc. Senator Shoemaker.
Madam Chair, I've just looked very quickly at this commitment procedure, and I don't see anything in here that would require the psychotherapist to detain the person until you can have a commitment hearing. And it looks like the commitment hearing is a rather long and involved procedure that requires an investigation, which may go on for a while. It is true that there are provisions that a judge may issue a warrant of detention. That's permissive and not mandatory, and it too has a procedure. So I guess I'm not satisfied that that is an appropriate safeguard of a person who is threatened with harm.
Okay.
And that's the whole purpose of this thing, is to protect a person threatened with harm and to protect the psychotherapist if he protects that person who's threatened with harm.
Okay, would you like to offer an amendment?
Well, I would like to move that we strike from the Dash 2 amendment, line 13.
Okay.
I do so.
Senator, Senator, I guess I'd ask, before we do this, I'd like to move the amendment, the chair would move the amendments 412-2 for discussion purposes, and then I'll take the motion to amend it. Is there objections to adopting 412-2 just for purposes of getting the bill into a shape that we can discuss? Hearing none, so ordered now. Senator Shoemaker has moved that we delete on line 13 of LC-2 that line dealing with civil commitment.
Yeah, I think we leave in the word or and move it up to line 12.
Okay. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
This is just on the motion to...
It's on the motion to delete line 13.
No.
Brockman?
This is, I'm sorry, I'm confused here, and I apologize.
Senator Shoemaker has moved to delete line 24A on your hand and gross bill, the redraft bill, which is corresponding line 13 on LC.
Yeah, this one.
Madam Chair, maybe I could have a minute of discussion then before we continue the vote. My concern is this, that the purpose of the bill is to protect somebody who is being threatened by a patient of a psychotherapist. And the trade-off for providing that the psychotherapist will do what he or she can to warn that person or the person's relatives is to protect the psychotherapist from liability for breaking the doctor-patient privilege. And essentially that's it. And it seems to me that's an appropriate trade-off, that it is important to protect people from physical harm. The psychotherapist is really in a bind when this is unfolding before him. And the society is better served by protecting the person threatened with harm than protecting the confidence between the psychotherapist and the patient. However, this seeking commitment as a way of protecting the patient, I don't think that does the job, because that takes a while. And the patient, I mean, of protecting the person, because that takes a while, and the patient can leave the clinic and go off and do the damage that he's threatened. And this imposes a duty on the psychotherapist to do one of these things. I guess I should have prefaced my remarks with that. The psychotherapist has a duty to warn under this bill. And that duty should be discharged by his actually warning and doing something that actually protects the person threatened. And merely seeking commitment seems like it's a way out.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to that, but doesn't it, in the lines just above that, they've already reported this person to the police department, and doesn't making a threat on someone's life or personal property or whatever this may be, doesn't that constitute an arrest? I mean, can't you arrest somebody for having done that?
Well, the thing is that these are disjunctive. They can do it by notifying the police, or by seeking commitment, or by notifying the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So you wouldn't have to notify the person threatened, or their parent, or the police, if you seek commitment. I read it.
Yes, Senator. In the original bill, it was an and.
Yeah.
And it was changed through the draft, through the amendments, correct?
Well, but I'm correct, though. But as it stands, the psychotherapist's duty to protect the threatened person will be fulfilled, as it's proposed, by doing nothing more than seeking commitment. It doesn't protect the threatened person.
Would you buy it if we changed it back to and?
No, I don't think it. I mean, I think it's well and good to seek commitment. I mean, I think they should certainly be encouraged to do that, but I think they also ought to warn people that are threatened. Maybe I'm missing something.
I don't think, Madam Chair, I don't think you'd necessarily have grounds to commit somebody. The grounds for commitment are not necessarily the same as
oh, yeah, I grant you that. I grant you that.
So, I mean, it's not always going to be the same.
Well, I guess I'll entertain the motion, and we'll continue to vote on it and see where we are. I think that if there is a concern, we can, in fact, folks can try to work it through in the House a little better. But
Senator Brennan, who's I have a different view of that than the Senator here, that it would be an action to try to protect this other person. Seeking commitment would be. That's why it's here, I think. Am I wrong in reading it that way?
Well, we're debating on whether, in fact, a seeking commitment, in fact, is an appropriate protection. I
understand that, but it is being offered here as one alternative of three to be chosen to protect this other person.
Right. And I question that it's
an appropriate action. Right.
It's also, Madam Chair, it's also the least restrictive thing to do, because in the other cases they have to divulge confidences. I don't think they would necessarily have to do that to start commitment proceedings.
I agree that's true.
And that might be the course they would take most likely rather than warning.
Okay, let's, I think we've had enough discussion.
Let's
retake the vote, Kiska, please, on Senator Shoemaker's motion to delete on the official LC-412-2, the seeking of commitment on Chapter 426, Line 13, which is a sub-B. Okay.
Brenneman?
No.
Brockman?
No.
B?
No.
No?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Keller?
Aye. Motion carried. Now, we have the bill before us.
I'll move the bill.
Wait, we need a Catherine Weber's amendment dated 4/4/89, which merely says the provisions of this bill apply only to causes of action arising on or after the effective date of the act.
Madam Chair, I'll move the Weber Amendment 4/4/89.
Okay. Senator Bremer moves the Weber Amendment. Are there objections? So ordered. Now.
I'll move it.
Senator Shoemaker moves Senate Bill 412 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. I think we've had enough.
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
No.
No?
No.
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Collins?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Now we have before us the Catherine is on her way out the door. Thank you very much for coming and working of an evening. We'll change counsel and we have Jack. This is a little warm up, folks. We have two bills remaining.
You're right, we probably will be here 3 hours.
Madam Chair, I'd serve notice of a possible minority report on 412.
Okay.
That took you long enough.
Well, I had to make sure if I had two or three to join, one or two others to join with me. I got at least one.
Why don't you just make the recall and make the motion of the table?
It's going to be an unholy alliance.
Right. It's just a little liability issue there.
Very little liability.
A little liability
very,
issue.
Very little liability.
Okay. Let's start with Senate Bill 275.
Senate Bill 275, you will recall, is the hearsay bill. We have some amendments in front of you that we've gone through before. I can go through those again if that's the wish. There is also an additional amendment, new material from the Oregon Psychological Association. You'll find that in your file as well. As you may recall, there are some on page 2 of the document that I've typed up for the committee, proposed amendments March 1989. There are some amendments that have been agreed to by a representative of the District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Governor's Council. The amendments on the first page are those amendments that have been proposed that have not been agreed to ahead of time. There are several interested parties here, representatives of OCDLA, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Governor's Council, as well as John Collins from the Yamhill County District Attorney's
Office. Why don't you go over for the committee the three issues of the bill that we're dealing with here?
Right. If you'll turn your attention to the first page of the amendments that I've typed up, I'd remind the committee these are in concept form. These are amendments on 275 that have been suggested by OCDLA, and they are, as I said, here to answer questions. The first major ground or major proposed amendment is one that I think Senator Shoemaker originally raised as an issue, at least remarked on it, and that amendment would amend out unavailability of the child as grounds for allowing hearsay statement. If this amendment were adopted, it would leave the bill in a position where it would still allow hearsay statements to be brought in as corroboration of the child's testimony when the child testifies. The further amendments are basically options to delete grounds for allowing hearsay in, and those grounds are incompetence or lack of memory. They would delete those from the definition of unavailability. The committee could choose to adopt deleting one or both, or for that matter, neither of those. Finally, at the bottom of the page, you'll find some additional language under paragraph D, and that language was originally suggested as a substitution for deleting incompetence or lack of memory as grounds for unavailability. That language was suggested by some national bar materials and basically says that the child is unavailable when the child persists in refusing to testify because of fear or some related reason, despite repeated judicial requests to do so.